Well, first, a report paints a stark picture of the environment under relentless pressure, with urban sprawl and dairy intensification swallowing up productive food-growing land. The Environment Ministry and Statistics New Zealand report documents land use in recent decades. It's the latest in a series of environmental reports based on themes such as air, marine, freshwater and climate. 15% of the country's land is considered highly productive, but the report finds it's constantly being eaten up by urbanisation and lifestyle blocks. The area of highly productive land lost to housing increased by 54% between 2002 and 2019. Around a third of the two highest classes of productive land across the country have already been or will soon be developed. In the past 25 years, land use has intensified. More livestock, fertilisers and irrigation on our farms, although overall there are actually fewer farms producing more product on less land. The number of dairy cows has doubled since the 1980s, rising from 3 million to almost 7 million in 2015, dropping back to 6 million in 2019. With this, irrigation has nearly doubled since 2002, most of it in Canterbury, and also radically on the rise is the use of fertiliser, with consequences for our climate emissions commitments. To have a look at the whole picture and to delve into some more details, we welcome the Environment Ministry's Chief Science Advisor, Alison Collins. Morning, Alison.
Morena.
And good morning also to Professor Amanda Black of Bioprotection Aotearoa at Lincoln University. Kia ora and welcome, Amanda.
Kia ora.
And a little later we'll hear from Horticulture New Zealand with their take on what this report has pulled together. But ladies, if we could begin with you. Alison, could you give us the overview? This looks back over two decades in particular. And what is the overall trend that we are seeing?
So the report brings together a whole variety of data sets, but also science literature to tell us a bit of a story about what's happening with our land and soils. And for me, I suppose the most pertinent message is that the decisions that we make about how we use our land, what we eat, where we live and how we make a living are made before we even set foot on the soil. And so we look a little bit into the drivers of what's shaping our land use, and then the effects of those activities on our land and soil.
The story over those past two decades, though, is that these highest quality soils, highest quality productive land is increasingly being utilised for housing and for lifestyle blocks. And we see it with our eyes, don't we? When we drive south of Auckland, when we drive north of Auckland, when we drive through Canterbury, when we drive in some of our big growing provincial areas around Bay of Plenty, around Nelson Tasman. That's what we see with our eyes. What are we seeing with the data?
So that's right. The data showing us, we know there's only 15% of land that's particularly good for production. That's what we call highly productive land. And that has, a benign climate, really good soils, and is sort of gently sloping or fairly flat. And it's typically around our city fringes. And we're seeing that that is being chewed up increasingly. And I think you quoted the statistic, 54% between 2002 and 2019. It increased by 54%, the loss of this really highly productive land, not just because of urban sprawl, but also land fragmentation. And this is where land is broken up into smaller parcels of land, anywhere between 2 and 5 hectares. So it might be for subdivisions, it might be for lifestyle blocks. So together with the urban sprawl and this land fragmentation, we're seeing a real threat to that very rare soil and land use and land area.
And what's on the drawing board? Because that startling statistic, again, is it a third of the two highest classes of land either already has been or is soon to be developed? Does that mean this is continuing at pace?
Yes, it does. About 80% of our population growth out to 2043 is expected to be in these main urban centres. And we've got some statistics, particularly for Auckland, that shows that, about 38% of Class 2 land, 34% of Class 1 land, and 19% of Class 3 land has or will be developed in the next few years, in the next decade.
Let's look at what's happened with agricultural production itself. The export income from farming products has risen, actually nearly doubling from 2010 to 2019. So at the time we are losing this productive land, we are seeing or have seen an extensive increase in production and in export value. However, this is happening on a smaller amount of land. I think the total land use for agriculture and horticulture has dropped back by 14% since 2002. 20,000 fewer farms, although perhaps larger, the entities that remain. So we are seeing at the same time a very considerable intensification on farming land, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So we're producing more on less land, which means that we're intensifying. And we can see that in the numbers. So dairy cattle numbers, as you quoted, have doubled since the 1980s and are sitting at 6 million in 2019. We're putting more fertiliser on and we're also irrigating more. So the use of irrigation, especially on land use for dairy farming, has nearly doubled since 2002. And there is a sort of a link between our reduction in highly productive land means that we're having to use other land that has requires more intensive inputs to get the same yield.
So this, and we're going to talk more about this in a moment with Amanda, but this is where different strands of thinking have to come together, because where are we seeing, well, we've seen your graphs and the report show it, irrigation has massively increased, and so too has the use of fertilisers, many of which will have implications for our climate emissions commitments and profile, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a very complex story. We've got, tensions between how we make decisions around what land we use, how we're using land, whether it's for housing, whether it's for food supply. And we know that this is also having consequences on climate change. But these decisions are going to become much more complex and uncertain as we go forward, because we know that population is going to grow and that also we're under a changing climate. So the decisions about how we use land are just going to become more and more difficult to make.
What happens, and again, Amanda might talk in more detail in a moment, but what happens when less highly productive land is converted to growing purposes? Is that happening at all?
We are seeing that. And what you need to do then to make that land produce the same yield is to have more inputs. So typically, higher stocking rates, more fertiliser, more irrigation.
The other strand, Alison, and you mention it in passing in the report, is that again as part of climate policy that's emerging, we're looking at a growing pressure to convert farmland to forestry, because then you get carbon sinks that can assist with the overall emissions profile. Are we beginning to see the encroachment of forestry onto what is regarded as highly productive growing land?
I don't think we touch on that in the report. What we do say is that indirectly climate change is having an impact on how we use land, because we're often using forestry to either mitigate or adapt to climate change. I don't think we talk about highly productive land and forestry. Typically your forestry is in different type of land use classes.
Thank you. Stay with us if you're able to. I understand if you're not, but I appreciate it. Let's bring in Amanda Black as well now. Professor Amanda Black is of Bioprotection Aotearoa at Lincoln University. Amanda, I think that's one of the Crown research institutes. Am I correct?
It's a Centre of Research Excellence.
Thank you. One better, perhaps. Thank you very much. So we've done the overview with Alison. Can I ask you for a little bit more detail about the issues surrounding the conversion of this highly productive land, this 15% of land left? Can we dig a little deeper, pardon the pun, into its value and the difference between it and less valuable land? What does it mean for soil quality? What is happening to our soil profiles? What does it mean for our farming and growing practices?
Thanks. So you're just following on from Alison's comments around, when you do cover over one of our higher class soils, and that's been identified as, you know, our most productive soils. And the reason why they're identified like that is because they have the ability to produce plants, because, I mean, that's the basis of our primary industry, with much less input and much less irrigation. These soils have the ability to hold nutrients, hold water much, much longer than, say, less quality soils. And so when you cover those over with houses and you start with the lifestyle blocks, that and those are really the beginning of the end, because once you're in a lifestyle block, there's nothing really you can do with that apart from, I guess, more wealthy people feel that they can have a more rural lifestyle when you actually can't produce anything. And so you're left with, I guess, marginal soils is what we tend to call it. And those soils have not as much capacity to hold nutrients and not as much capacity to hold water. And so what you tend to do is have to pour a more synthetic fertiliser and irrigate it more. And then you get these spillover effects into the environment of runoff into streams, percolating nitrogen into groundwater, and just erosion as well. And these areas, particular areas that you don't have a lot of water, say Canterbury is one that I'm thinking of, and that you have to irrigate more than there's actually water available to do. So it's not sustainable in the long term. The other thing with fragmentation, urban sprawl comes under the sort of fragmentation. When you fragment an ecosystem, and farming is an ecosystem, it's just one that's highly managed, is that you start to lose its resilience to, say, pest invasions, to weed invasions, and they become more disease and weed and pest prone. But when you get urban encroachment, that there's less you can do about it, because, you know, the typical tools used to control these sort of biosecurity impacts, ones that you can't really do around the public, spraying, poisoning, and shooting of rabbits. And so it really does change the way how you manage the land.
What is the story globally with topsoil, and where does it sit in the sort of the spectrum of the quality of growing soils? Because it's basically disappearing, isn't it? And could you could you explain a little bit more about how precious this kind of productive land is, and whether, as I've seen some suggest, it almost needs a protection of some sorts because it's not replaceable?
That's right, it's not. And all that, I mean, people, I guess, view soil as it's all the same. It's not. It's an ecosystem in itself. And it's the top 10% of the soil, so the topsoil that gets removed through development, is where all the biological activity happens, all the nitrogen retention, all the nutrient retention, all the water holding capacity, and the ability to store carbon. And I think a lot of people don't realise the, the soil's role in the whole carbon sequestration and the global climate regulation side of things is that soil actually holds four times more carbon than, say, plants. And so, again, once you cover that and once you change that, you reduce the soil's ability to sequester carbon as well.
We have a forthcoming interview on Monday on the phrase is regenerative farming. You always get wary whenever there's a word around something because people tend to roll their eyes. But basically it's farming the way it used to be, right, which was less monoculture and more using all elements of ecosystem to replace, as you say, the kind of intensive fertilisers or water intensification that's needed. As we see growing interest in a return in some parts of farming to this kind of more traditional farm management, how dependent on that will be the right land?
So regenerative agriculture means different things to different people, but it comes from the area where, particularly in the States, in Australia, where they've depleted the soil so much of carbon that they have to look at ways to put it back. And so that is changing the way you do things. So in New Zealand, we're kind of at the crossroads of doing business as usual, so doing whatever we want, wherever we want, and not looking at soil as a resource, as a tong, I suppose. But then we're getting to the point where we can't really do that. And so what other ways can we keep production? Because, I mean, if anything, the global pandemic has shown us food security is a priority. But with less input and appropriate irrigation. And so using different systems to help build that resilience into a sort of more intergenerational approach is something that I think we're going to have to move towards.
Can we talk about some of the key measures? And I know these are going to come through, they're already beginning to come through as national standards effectively for farming. Things like the amount of nitrates, things like the amount of phosphorus. What measures are there now of what's happening to those profiles and why are they important?
We measure things like Olsen P and certain levels of nitrogen because it's not always available to the plant, and that's what we're looking at, is like how available is this element to the plant. And the report highlights that I think there's no real change in Olsen P, but that's not really the issue. The issue is the accumulation in the soil, and when you irrigate that, a significant proportion of that phosphorus ends up in waterways. And you end up with issues like we have in Canterbury with Lake Forsyth, where it's completely toxic. And that's actually not fertiliser, but that's what happens when you get erosion and you cut all the trees down. And all that topsoil that's high in phosphorus ends up in the waterways and you end up with toxic algal blooms.
Nationwide.
And so what we're measuring is...
Go ahead. No, you carry on.
No, it's what we're measuring is fine, but I think we need to add to that. We've got a couple of issues with having no real long-term monitoring sites that we're not able to pick up good trends, and that I think climate change is the one that we only lightly touch on in the report, and we've got to figure out how we can measure that to determine trends going forward. And so that is really about more like biological activity in the soil.
Nationwide, 80% of soil monitoring sites, such as they are, failed to meet the targets for at least one soil quality indicator. Now, is that on very highly productive land, or is that on all land that is used for farming?
That'll be on all land used for farming.
Okay. Let's just touch on climate change again and the role we're going to have measurements for nitrates in particular. I mentioned potential pressure. It's a bit of speculation, but we know we're hearing from farmers in Hawke's Bay and in Horowhenua about the temptation to sell up land to foresters who will use it for climate sequestration purposes. Do you believe this is a question that at least needs to be asked, Amanda, how climate policy is going to sit alongside whatever comes out of your work here and whatever comes out of future government policies?
I think so. We really have to think quite carefully how we do this. A knee-jerk reaction is to plant more pine, and and that's fine, but it only buys us 15 years because that's the lifetime of the rotation, the crop rotation, and that's, you can only do that in certain areas that you don't want to use for food growing. I mean, it's, you want to use it in like high country type areas where you don't, you can't grow food, or it makes it logistically difficult to grow food, and you can't really have dairying and things like that. So it's not going to be a black and white or a straightforward approach. We really have to see what's appropriate.
Again, a difficult question, but are the agricultural emissions targets that we are asking of the primary sector and are going to be increasingly asking of the primary sector going to be achievable if we don't have sufficient of this highly productive land? In other words, if we can't adapt practices from the high intensification of the last two decades?
It would be extremely difficult without intervention tools.
Thank you. Alison Collins, can I come back just with one more question for you? Because one thing that, again, we notice visually when we drive south of Auckland, we drive north of Auckland, increasingly we drive north of Wellington, and one can go to some of the provincial areas and see the potential as well. We're building highways right alongside and right through our most highly productive land. And then logically next to the highway might be the development of further public transport, but logically it's also where a lot of housing development's going to go. Is this a question that councils and governments need to ask themselves right now, or in fact are we at risk of the horse having bolted?
I think it's a question that many of us have been asking for a long time, and it just shows the incredible value of land to all aspects of our life. I can't comment particularly on the perspective of government or regional councils. What I can say is there is a comprehensive policy reform program underway at the moment to tackle these tensions.
Thank you, both of you. I really appreciate your input. Mike Chapman from Chief Executive of Horticulture New Zealand. Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
What is your take? This is pulling the data together on an issue we've discussed numerous times and that your sector has been flagging. Here's the hard data. What's your take on it?
Well, it's a call to arms. And as you've just been talking, it's getting nearly too late to do things which will make great sense. Now, we can have houses and we can have healthy food, but we need to decide how we're going to do it and make sure we do protect the land, which is really productive. And as you've just pointed out, really good for climate change adaptation. So what we've been asking for some time is a national policy statement to protect and make sure that highly productive land is kept for production so that going into the future we can feed New Zealand and meet our climate change commitments.
Let's talk about how decisions are made now. How much of these decisions about what goes where are currently made by councils who we know are hungry for rates income, need to house people? How many decisions get made by territorial authorities?
Well, they are the people who make the decisions. And what we're asking for is for a national directive to the councils saying when you are looking at subdivision, you need to take into account many things. And one of those things is protecting the highly productive land that is good for growing. That doesn't mean that all land will end up being protected. But what it does mean is the councils will have a better policy consideration before they decide to rezone and see land go out of growing our healthy food.
Do you believe there needs to be a designation across those very high quality soils that are left?
I wouldn't go that far because I think as you plan, you've got to have the flexibility to make decisions about, you know, where you might put houses and what things you might do. And, you know, the national policy statement that is being developed gives that balancing effect. So we really need to get that launched because that will then be a direction to councils to consider all sorts of things before they put houses on land. And those things really relate to protecting that highly productive land when that is necessary.
The RMA reform is imminent. We've talked a lot about the three waters changes yes. that may be coming that could potentially remove from councils a lot of say over water. And the RMA may well, as is expected, take further decision-making and centralise it away from councils. What is your view on where decisions about these matters properly sits?
Look, I think they sit with central government because this is a whole country strategy. It's about our food security for the future. It's about our climate adaptation. So I don't think councils are the right people because they don't have a whole of country view. And my view is that we should be really strategically planning how we're going to feed people, where we're going to put houses, and making sure we can meet our climate change and other commitments.
Where do you see some of the great vulnerabilities? One looks at great growing areas like Nelson Tasman, which also happens to have a lovely climate and a very beautiful backdrop. Around Tauranga, we know, in Bay yes. of Plenty, the population's going gangbusters. We know we've got a growing population cohort reaching retirement. Are these questions urgent before yes. we see more plastering over prime soils?
Yes. Totally urgent because, you know, we're on the cusp of an enormous expansion of housing. And as was said before, it's not just housing, it's where you get lifestyle and small blocks which break up the productive area and make it very difficult to be productive in those areas. So it's nearly past time for action.
Thanks all of you for the conversations. Mike Chapman is Chief Executive of Horticulture New Zealand. Amanda Black, I was speaking to, also has contributed to this report. She is based at Bioprotection Aotearoa at Lincoln University, Crown Institute of Research Excellence. And thanks also to the Environment Ministry's Chief Science Advisor, Alison Collins. Those national policy statements or standards are expected, I think. The draft ones may be out before the end of this year. It's a subject I'm sure we'll return to.